once more unto the breach, dear friends.
Else fill up the wall with our English dead.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, and welcome back to another exciting episode of the Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jake and
Jeff
McClure, where we are known to sometimes appropriately say our names at the same time. There. We're done for the week, and we should go home. Nope, we've got disclosures before we leave. First disclosure, we are bald, both of us. Bearded, bald people. I know if that didn't scare you away and cause you to change the channel immediately, bear with us. We're going to bore you with more disclosures. The name of this program is not coincidentally also the name of an SEC-registered investment advisory firm called the Personal Wealth Coach. The people talking on this radio program are the principals of that firm. What does it mean to be registered with the SEC? It means that they are the ones that get us in trouble if we do something bad. It doesn't mean that they have given us any kind of approval or pats on the head, bald heads, by the way. And just because we're registered with them as at the firm level to give investment advice, we can't do that on the radio. Fiduciary investment advice requires us to know you. I know, that's really weird. And actually give you advice based on your circumstance. It also requires us to keep some level of privacy with that advice. So the act of broadcasting, it kind of shoots that in below the whole line, if you know what I mean. So this is not advice. It is education. Why do we do this? I'm not sure. Partial insanity, possibly. But we do. So we're giving you, hopefully, some education. We will take that mud and possibly turn it into muddy water so that you may be able to hear blues music. No, sorry, wrong muddy water. You may possibly have slightly better understanding of the world of finance. You want to deem for us?
Well, the information that we present on this educational radio program has been obtained from sources we deem to be reliable. However, we make no warranty or guarantee as to the accuracy or completeness of said information. However, we will warranty and guarantee that unsaid information is incomplete.
Are you sure?
Yes.
Oh, very nice.
I warranty and guarantee that. Oh, yes. And if you wish to contact us.
One more disclosure we have to add in here. We don't pay for this radio program.
That's right.
This is not paid commercial programming. We also are not paid for this program. We have been doing this. Older Baldy's been doing this since 1997, which is significantly longer than I have in younger Baldy here. I've been doing it since 1998. So he has a good 8 to 12 months advantage on me on the radio program. Combined, can we combine that? Combined experience on the
I think it was 96, but I may be wrong.
Okay, so you might be 18 months ahead of me on that.
Probably. That's about right.
Man, I'm never going to catch up.
No, let's not combine experience.
Because we could have, you know, half a century or more of combined experience here.
I've always considered such claims to be false and deceptive and manipulative.
Yes, combined experience when you're experiencing the same thing is not cumulative. There we go. That's a good statement.
Non-cumulative combined experience.
Right.
Well, prices may be higher or lower when sold than when purchased.
Uh-huh. Do you ever purchase a price?
Yes.
Okay.
When the price is right.
We have email addresses.
We do.
It's amazing. You can join the conversation via email. Please do not email while driving.
Wait a minute. I've emailed while driving.
Yeah, please don't.
I do.
It causes insurance rates to go up after the accident.
I talk to my phone. I talk to the car, and it sends texts and emails.
That's very nice. Well, the car is sending it then.
Oh, okay.
If you'd like to join us through those email addresses, the addresses in here are jeff@tpwc.com and jake@tpwc.com, as in Tango, Papa, Whiskey, Charlie, or the Personal Wealth Coach. What happened this week in the market?
Do you remember back when you were much younger?
No.
And I was too. And the concept of talking to your car and your car answering you was pure science fiction.
Yes, and the act of walking down the street, if you saw someone approaching you with no one around them, talking animatedly with their hands moving, it was generally a homeless person. And
yeah.
Now it's not.
All right, I got that. Oh, well. Well, so what happened this week? The stock market performed unpleasantly. As a matter of fact, I loved one of the headlines. Worst performance by the S&P 500 since June.
Oh.
July, August. That's 2.5. Yeah. Worst performance in a couple of months.
Yeah. We don't have to have a very long tape measure for this particular measurement here. Okay. This is the very worst that we've experienced all day.
Yeah. That's
makes a good headline. It's a good headline.
Yeah. I can see. Well, considering that the news cycle, which used to run, was 24-hour news cycle, which was big with the cable news. And it was once a week. The news cycle used to run a week. And before that, it ran a month. And now I think it runs 10 seconds, the news cycle. And it starts all over again.
They go really fast, so nobody can understand it. But they can all get worked up because they say words like worst and impossible and destructive very quickly.
Severe and violence. And okay, anyway.
Whoa, this is horrible. I want to keep listening.
We're back to a one-week news cycle in the market. It was a rough week. The S&P 500... dropped 4.77%. It closed at 3873.33. I remember I saw the headline go by. S&P 500 drops below 3900. Is this the beginning of the crash? No.
Well, it was. It was the beginning of a crash that lasted that long. It may last longer. What is a crash?
It was horrific because it dropped. The technical guy said it dropped below 3900, which is a resistance level, which meant that it was going to plunge to 3,000 or something, which it didn't, of course, nobody pays any attention to the fact that they were wrong. Anyway, it was down. It's now down 19.
We just paid attention to it.
We did.
You and I just recognized that sometimes.
Nobody. We count as nobody. The market anyway wound up at, like I said, at 30, the stock market represented by the Standard & Poor's 500 stock index, affectionately known as SPX, is at 3873.33 when it closed on Friday. It's down about 19.2% from its high back in January. It's up 5.63% from its low point in June. It's down 12.62% from this time last year. And it's up 35.27% from 3 years ago.
Wait a minute. You just said it's up, it's down, it's up, it's down. What?
Isn't that a perfect description of the market?
Absolutely. And when people say, is the market up or down? I'm like, well, how long have you been paying attention? If you've been paying attention a long time, it's really up. If you just started paying attention, it's down. There you go.
I must admit that I have an emotional reaction to a stock market that falls 4.77% in a week. And it's not a pleasant emotional reaction because I once was a stockbroker. But I like Morningstar's comment on it. At the beginning of the month, they said, in their opinion, and I think Morningstar's opinion is certainly worth listening to, the market was seriously undervalued at the beginning of the month, and it's lower now, which tells me a lot.
It's under the undervalue.
Yeah, it's undervalued. Perhaps the most impressive thing, and this is something to put it in perspective, you wrote this in the newsletter. Those of you who have really, really, really long memories and are really old can remember all the way back to 2020.
Wait a minute. Let me get the book out. I got it. This is before the internet, right? 2020. Oh, that wasn't.
No,
there we go. Okay, I found it.
No, it's the one that the song was about. Anyway,
Yeah.
If you go all the way back to 2020 in March, and you measure the return of the Standard & Poor's 500 stock index from mid-March, it's up 73%.
Well, mid-March was the month that we all realized that this weird letter number combination thing that might make your nose run might actually kill you, and we all shut down.
Right.
So having it up 70%+ since then is reasonable.
But it's also up from where it was before it started down. And why am I saying all this? There's a tendency, if you are invested in the stock market and you read the news media publications or watch, above all, if you watch television, particularly the news channels, to way overreact to movements, short-term movements in the market. It's a very important thing to say, to know and get clearly in your mind whether you are a speculator or an investor. Traders or speculators, buy it and watch what happens. And if it goes the wrong way, sell it immediately. That is, watch is where the word speculate comes from. And if you're an investor,
yes, spectate.
By definition, you are a long-term investor, or you're not an investor. Long-term, the shortest definition of long-term I have ever heard is 3 years. And 10 years is probably a better definition. And if you look at where the stock market is today versus where it was even 3 years ago, when the economy was doing quite well, you have to conclude that the market is up. And it's really, in my opinion, a good idea to keep that minimum time period. If we have a client, for example, that anticipates needing money in 3 years, a significant amount of money, we start to get very conservative in many ways, and at least with that portion of the portfolio. Why? Because 3 years is such a short period of time in the market. So the angst involved in moment-to-moment market movements is something that I realize you have if you follow these things. It's something I realize that I have, but it's something I think we always need to fight. Anyway, back to the market. The stated reason for the fall this week in the publications, every publication I read.
Yeah, all the headlines said this.
Was that the trailing 1 year consumer price index number came in only slightly lower than last month.
Which
it was at 8.3 rather than 8.5. And before that, it was at 8.7. And since the consumer price index is going down.
There was a consensus among economists that said instead of 8.1, it would be 8.0.
It was 8.3.
Oh, yeah. I'm sorry. It was going to be 8.0 instead of 8.3. So it was down from 8.5 to 8.3. Right. But it wasn't at 8.0, so we had a massive drop in the market. That's what everybody's talking about, right?
Not necessarily true, but that was what people were saying,
right?
Apparently, at least according to the reporting.
And then you add FedEx on top of it, as that's also been FedEx in the headlines.
Was the big thing, and they said since FedEx reported fewer packages being delivered and they were going to shut down airplanes and lay people off, they said, "Oh no, FedEx represents the entire economy. Panic, run." Run for the door. Nah, it doesn't work that way. Anyway.
We have to read deeper. And reading deeper is not that difficult. We'll get to it. Go ahead.
But it takes time. Anyway, so let's go on. We also follow another index, the CRSP Mid-Cap Value Index. Why do we call it? Because value is something. Mid-cap value is an asset class that we like a lot and we pay a lot of attention to. It did drop 4.88% for the week. It's down at 2294.29. It's down 11.66 from its high in January, and it's down 5.97% from a year ago. And it's notable to note, I like that smaller stocks historically have been more volatile than larger stocks, except right now the smaller stocks in the mid-cap value side are less volatile. And there's a lot of reason for that, but that would take an entire show. Anyway, benchmark U.S. Treasury 10-year note yield. That's the one that all the rest of them seem to reference. The yield rose 4.3% to 3.455%. Yay for the week, I guess. The 2-year yield is at 3.85. What that means is the yield curve is inverted. It is decidedly negative.
Why is the yield curve negative and important thing to be talking about? And the answer to that directly is that shorter term yields being higher than longer term yields. This is like if you went to the bank to get a mortgage and they charged you more on the gave you a higher interest rate for a 10-year mortgage than a 30-year mortgage. That's backwards, because they're risking their money for 30 years at a low interest rate and don't want to risk their 10-year money because they're charging a higher interest rate. That the shorter term periods are where corporations get short-term loans to do expansions, to hire new people, or to buy equipment and so on. And so when it's inverted, that kind of expansion slows down drastically. Businesses don't buy as much new equipment. This is the concept behind it anyway. It isn't always laid out that way, but that's the concept. So back to you. Mm-hmm. You're back.
Well, in severe recessions that I've seen in the past, and this is certainly the academics have looked at this and written volumes about it, but here's the point. we really don't have enough yield curve measured recessions in our history to get a meaningful sample. We just haven't been measuring it that long. And the end result is that the inverted yield curve may indicate a recession is coming, and it may not. But in the major recessions that I have personally seen, and this is very subjective, the entire yield curve goes negative.
Yeah. We've never had a recession without a negative yield curve, but we've had negative yield curves without recessions.
That's right.
So it's like an SAT question there, but follow along.
Anyway, so it's out there, and that's all I can say. Texas Intermediate crude oil prices were stable. They didn't go up. They moved less than 1% during the week, $85.27 per barrel. Now, it's important to note the price of oil, because inflation has tended to follow the price of oil. We're going to get into that later in the program. But there's another thing I want to mention before we leave markets. Bonds are supposedly reliable, historically rule of thumb, reliable alternative to stocks, so that if you mix your stocks and bonds, you have a relatively smooth ride. I heard that for many years from many people. The Bloomberg Aggregate Bond Index is down about 15% this year. Let me say that again. It's down about 15% this year. Go back to the Mid-Cap Value Index, which is stocks, down 11.66% this year. In other words, the bond market as a whole, measured by the Bloomberg Aggregate Bond Index, is actually down more than large portions of the stock market. Okay, well, if you don't go to bonds and you don't go to stocks, you ought to go to gold, right? Well, gold is down about 18% from its high in March. So gold is down 18% from its high. The Bloomberg Aggregate Bond Index is down 15%. And stocks, if you're looking at the S&P 500, is down 19.2. If you're looking at mid-cap value, it's down 11.66. If your portfolio is down at this point, don't feel like you made bad choices.
Yeah.
Because it doesn't make any difference where you invested. It's probably down, and somebody could respond, yeah, well, I invested in houses. Well, the problem is houses aren't very liquid. Well, except when the creek floods, then they get very liquid.
And there's another term for them when they're really, really not liquid is when they're underwater.
Right.
Because you owe more on them than they're worth. And it wasn't that long ago in my memory that was a pretty normal thing coming out of the global financial crisis. So people are saying, well, I'm in real estate and it's good. Well, how have you tried selling recently?
Yeah. And the prices are coming down on real estate too. And matter of fact, some of the headlines that we didn't talk too much about is how the prices of housing are starting to fall. But you can't see that very quickly because it's not a liquid bid auction market that's reported every day. But the prices of housing in many places are starting to come down.
Correct.
Rather than go up. And they're coming down rather quickly, which is understandable because
mortgage rates are above
6%. And that is a huge increase over the 2-point-something% mortgage rates you could get a year ago, and raises the payments on houses dramatically. I suspect we're going to see a minor crisis in the real estate market before too long.
I'll throw in some market data on real estate here. Purchase applications are down 20% year over year. This is from Bloomberg. The housing inventory, which is one of the things that we watch to see whether it's a buyer's market or a seller's market. And when there's not a lot of inventory out there, it's definitely a seller's market. They get to say what they want to sell it for because the people that are in the market don't have a lot of choices. Back in January, across the country, we had 2.1 months of inventory. That means houses on average moved in a 2.1 month cycle, and that was everything on the market in any given moment. It's doubled that to 4.1 now. There are now 4 months of sales on the market versus 2 months of sales on the market, which means that it's becoming more and more of a buyer's market. Now, there's a lot more room for that to grow. The inventories can get bigger, and people are putting their houses on the market faster than they did last year, because they're seeing the prices start to peter off at the top and maybe start to drop. And they say, I've been waiting and I've been waiting and now I need to get out before. That's usually when they really drop is when people rush in and say, I need to sell, I need to sell. That's the definition of a buyer's market. Okay, back to you.
Well, we can move on to the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics, otherwise affectionately known by its friends and neighbors as BLS.
I like to drop the L off occasionally just for the fun of it.
The BS?
Yes. They're not that, but it's still fun to do occasionally.
Well, yeah. Well, BLS, I like BLS. Mm-hmm. BLS. Anyway, the Consumer Price Index dash U, by the way, when they say the CPI, there are a host of CPIs, and the ones that they actually report are the C are the dash U, which is for urban workers. Yes, rural people aren't reported on. Anyway, it was up 8.3% from a year ago. Okay, what does that mean? Not much, because we had a burst of inflation earlier this year that peaked in June. Now, I want to say this very carefully. Even the core CPI for 1 year is up 6.3%, and that is big compared with recent history. But here's the key thing. The inflation for July and August was effectively, according to the CPI, zero. So prices did not rise in July, and average prices.
Let's cover that just a second. You know, we just said that it was up over 8%. That's from a year before. Mm-hmm. If you compare just from 1 month to the next, there was no movement, which means we're not experiencing further inflation this month than we did last month. Okay, go ahead.
And if you actually look at the average, there's another report that they come out with. Actually, it's part of a big report. The average cost of living, CPI, in cities across the United States, if you just look at that, it was zero in July and zero in August, rise in the cost of living. Now, did individual things rise in there and other things fall? Yes. And admittedly, the reason it was zero is because the price of gasoline and fuel in general, they refer to that as energy, and for that matter, electricity, dropped 7% and 10% respectively in those months. So they said, well, inflation is still there because the stuff that's not fuel went up. Well, yeah, but let's back up and look at that. The price of fuel and energy, let's call that energy in general, went up dramatically before the price of everything else went up. Why has that happened? Because there is an energy component in the price of literally everything you buy, because it has to be moved from somewhere to where you are, and it has to be made by somebody using something that consumes energy or fuel, in other words, or electricity. So there is a noticeable lag that often runs about 3 months and sometimes longer between the time the price of fuel levels off or falls back, which it does, it goes up and down, and the time you start seeing that reflected in stuff. Now, there's another thing I want to hit here, if I can ramble on a little longer, Jake.
Sure.
There's another leading indicator when it comes to inflation that it really is. There's two of them that need to be watched if you're concerned about what you think inflation is going to do. One of them is the producer price index. The producer price index for August was a negative 0.1%. It's the prices are coming down at the producer. That's wholesale level. It's actually the producer price index for final demand, which means just before it's given to a retailer, what are the prices doing? And they are coming down. Then look at a little further upstream, imports. We import a lot of stuff. If you don't believe we import a lot of stuff, go to Walmart. If you go to Walmart, where they used to proclaim that made in the USA, they wouldn't carry anything that wasn't made in the USA. Now, if you go, they probably ought to have a sign up that says we don't carry anything that's not made in China. But if you look at the prices, you look in Walmart, you can see we buy a lot of stuff from overseas. We buy a tremendous amount of stuff. And as a result, the price of stuff, which is an economics term we use for goods, because I don't like the term goods because the opposite would be bads. The goods that come in from overseas, which we call stuff, dropped significantly. Import prices have been falling now for 27 weeks. Now, what does that mean? That means upstream prices are coming down. We're seeing what is affectionately known by economists as disinflation. I have never, by the way, understood the difference between deflation and disinflation, but apparently what we're getting now is disinflation.
Yeah. What is it? When the average is positive, but you're experiencing less inflation. So you have an average inflation, but it's less than what it was before. That's disinflation. When you have a negative inflation rate, that's deflation, where it goes negative numbers like across on an average.
That's what we've been seeing. We've been seeing prices falling, going down. You know, you're shaking your head now.
Yeah. Our growth in inflation is falling.
No.
So we went.
The actual growth in inflation not falling on these prices. They're actually, it's not a matter of they're inflating less. In other words, they cost less this month than they did last month than they did the month before.
Sure. And you're talking about an individual product, and I'm talking about a large average of the entirety. That's what I'm saying, is that our CPI is still up, but it's less up than it was because of disinflationary influences on certain parts of it.
Well, that's what I'm saying is that the producer price index isn't up a less, it's now down. For 2 months. Sure. And the import prices are now down for 27 weeks. They've been falling for 27 weeks, which sounds to me like
those are
deflationary.
It is. If the entire nation was experiencing those price rises across the entire of everything, that would be deflation.
Right.
But those pieces, imports, are down, the prices are down on imports, so you would think that's deflation. But when you throw it into the mix with everything else that we buy, it's just disinflation, which is really goofy because it doesn't, I mean, we don't have a word for it on the other end.
I got
you. So if you're in deflation, you don't have deflation.
I know that when the prices...
It's just silly words that somebody wanted to put into an academic paper and get credit for it.
I know when those prices upstream went up, they called it inflationary. And now that it's coming down, they call it disinflationary, but not deflation. And that's guess what? Anyway, what I'm trying to say here is that prices upstream in the supply chain are coming down. And they're coming down nicely. And this would indicate to me that we may have seen the end of high inflation. Now, it's going to have to be a year from now before we see, looking back 1 year, what happened and say, wow, we didn't have any inflation over the last year. So inflation numbers are way, way down.
Well, and I'll give you a little bit of schadenfreude here so that, it's no fun having inflation up in the 8% year over year. Even though we've got month to month, very little inflation, it's still a year ago. Everybody feels it. It's not gone. All right. Argentina. Have you seen any of the news on Argentina? They're raising their interest rates to 75%.
Oh, yeah, I saw that.
This is the short-term rates at the banks where they pay, you know, like when our Federal Reserve, we're talking about getting it up around in the 3% mark. They're at 75% because their inflation rate is at 80% or 79%. That is worse than here, to put it lightly. European countries are experiencing 9%+ across the entirety of the EU, and I believe the UK is at 13%. So, our low 8% number is looking better.
I can actually top Argentina.
Oh, really?
Yeah, Turkey.
Turkey's
80.2%. Their August inflation rate was 80.2%.
So they are 0.5% higher in Turkey than in Argentina.
They're 79% Argentina?
79 point something. They just raised their interest rates to 75%, which isn't going to stop inflation as long as interest rates are below. Yeah. Anyway, go ahead.
So, and then they're expecting 20% inflation rate in the United Kingdom.
Yeah.
In England.
For the coming future, yes. So it feels better knowing that now. I've always wondered why it is, I broke my leg. Well, some people have their legs amputated. Well, that doesn't make me feel better that somebody, thank you for telling me that, I guess, but I guess we can point at somebody else feeling things worse than us and say, well, at least we're the best worst going on out there.
Least worst. I like that too. Now
I prefer bratwurst, but the bratwurst inflation rate is rather high in the EU right now. So,
Microsoft Word wanted me to put least bad, but I decided to put least worse when I write.
That makes sense.
I like that.
You can have the least worse. It's the extreme of the extreme in the opposite extreme, which is.
And there's other stuff going on in the world too. The Chinese economy looks like it is resting on a Ponzi scheme that is falling apart.
Yep. And we'll talk about we've got a question hanging out there. We've gone nearly 40 minutes of our radio program without covering Inquisitor John's question. It's a good one, if a bit obscure. John, our chief inquisitor and most loyal questioner, sends, as is tradition, pictures taken with his phone of the paper version of the Wall Street Journal through digital email that we may look at it with his pen writing on it. His question in the email is, what types and how large money-wise are these investments that are being reviewed by this group? The subject is foreign investment. It's there's a headline in the Wall Street Journal saying foreign investment scrutiny tightened. First off, what group are we talking about? What's going on here? During the Trump administration, a law was passed instituting a review of strategic enterprises with the executive branch's ability to stop purchases from foreign nationals and foreign governments. So the committee that was formed by that law, by the Terra law, Firma law, it's Firma law, was the Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States. Now, this committee has 9 cabinet-level departments part of it. It's not very well organized yet. The turnaround time on this is a lot longer than the requirement says it will be. What does it cover? If you have a company or any United States company that has contracts with the U.S. government or is part of infrastructure, whether that be a port authority or a electric company or a nuclear power plant or a software company that's doing encryption for the U.S. government, you fall under the authority of CFIUS, the Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States. And it makes sense. It's a really good idea. The Trump administration was signed off on it. President Trump signed the bill. Congress was Republican when it was passed. And by executive order, President Biden strengthened it. So this is something that I think everybody can look at, Democrat or Republican, and agree, yeah, we don't want China owning our encryption methodologies. We don't want China owning the company that builds our nuclear submarines. We don't want Lockheed Martin to be owned by Russia. So the size of the investment, and this is the question, how big are they? How much money are we talking about? What are they looking for? And the answer to that, what types and how large money-wise are these investments? It can be as little as a penny. Any foreign investment into strategic areas has to be looked at by this committee. Now, how is it looked at? This is where things are not so organized. They're beginning to build the concept of who falls under their authority. There's a blanket of anybody that has ever had a contract with the U.S. government. That's what it says in the law. Well, that could have been 30, 40 years ago if you're IBM. So they're having to put some regulations in place to say, what does that really mean? Active contracts, contracts that you're about to be active on, also infrastructure areas. So how does it work? Currently, let's put some air quotes around this, voluntary notice given by the company to the committee. And that's it. There's a form that they fill out and they send it in. It's a voluntary notice. If they don't do the voluntary notice, they can lose their company, which is why I had the air quotes around the word voluntary. You can voluntarily tell us about this or we're going to come and take it from you. Which if you are, if you're dealing with children and you say this is a voluntary thing or you're in trouble, you've been voluntold. So the committee voluntells the companies that they need to send these notices. The enforcement on this doesn't really exist yet, but it will. They haven't determined which of the 9 cabinet level departments are going to enforce it, because that's not really in the law. It just says that it will be enforced. So there is jockeying for power. Who's in charge of this? Who's in charge of that? Who's got the chair of the committee? Who's the one that determines what's being talked about? That's all part of the organizational process. And the committee was only formed in January. because that's when the law really came into effect. So there, nobody really knows yet. But the specific question is, how large money-wise are these investments and what types? So I think I covered that. As large as a penny, as long as it's considered a strategic company. That definition is very vague. The president can come in and say, IBM, you're now a strategic company and you've got a lot of foreign investments. So
yeah, but one of the issues is, obviously, if a company is publicly traded on the New York Stock Exchange or wherever, people from outside of the United States can buy the shares. So you're just not going to find any company that's publicly traded in the United States of any size that does not have a foreign ownership component. And I really think if they ever try to start enforcing that, they are going to find that the courts will throw it out and laugh as they go.
So the core reasoning in the law, we can all agree on how it is enforced and who it is enforced on is where the quibbling is going to come. And it's probably going to get settled in court over the next four decades. So talk about an obscure question and an even more obscure answer. Here you go.
The law was a feel-good law. It was a political law that was passed quickly, signed by the president, and everybody said, yeah, we got a law against foreigners owning strategically critical United States companies or owning enough of them they can steal secrets or whatever. The problem is the law was so vague.
And well, here's the benefit from it, and this is a good thing. As long as the president at any given time doesn't go nuts with this, it's a good thing. The president can step in based on any voluntary filing of a form. It doesn't have to come from the company, and stop a large purchase of a company by a foreign power based on strategic means.
Sure.
It was much harder to do before. The Justice Department had to get involved, and they had a whole series of things they had to jump through to get it stopped. At this point, we have a law that doesn't have much in the way of court cases behind it. So the government can stop a merger or a purchase or an acquisition at a moment's notice, and they have to figure out how to contest that in the courts. So it'll be a long enough pause for investigation to go through to say whether or not it's a good idea to go forward.
Yeah, I think it's the best way. Controlling interest.
Yeah, go ahead.
And they put controlling interest in there in that law. I would say, yeah, that makes sense.
Well, one of the problems with controlling interest versus not is, I'll use an extreme example. Let's say Huawei, the Chinese phone company that has a history of stealing technology from other phone companies that are manufacturing in China. By a history of it, I mean, it's a blatant history of theft. They got 5G technology before any of their Western rivals because they combined all their Western rivals' research into one research compendium library and came out with it first. If they say, we're going to buy a company that does broadband in the United States, and we're going to buy a bunch of the broadband infrastructure, and there's fiber optic cable that goes to the Defense Department somewhere in that infrastructure that they're buying. The ability to stop that is very limited by the government without this law. So this law comes in and they say, all right, now we have a big tool that's basically got nothing stopping it until it gets to court cases. So the law says that they can just stop it. They can seize, the U.S. government can seize the assets of the company being purchased. So like that now becomes government property. That big fiber wire that's going from one place to another is now government property. Well, there's a constitutional issue there. You know, you can't, eminent domain has to occur. You actually have to buy it. No matter if Congress passes or not, it's a constitutional level thing. The government can't seize assets without properly bidding on it or looking at the price and offering a market rate. So it's a complicated area, and it's a good thing that we have it, but it's definitely too vague. So I would rather they get, man, are we nerds when we're talking about, if you look at the regulatory aspect of that thing and how complex it is, and we're saying it's too vague. It'd be a lot easier if it was written in plain English so that we could say this is what it means. But if you go to the U.S. Treasury website, you're going to need four attorneys with eight opinions to get an idea of what's going on. And we got to play some commercials. If you'd like to join us as we're coming back from commercials, the email addresses in here are jeff@tpwc.com and jake@tpwc.com. That's Tango Papa Whiskey Charlie or The Personal Wealth Coach. And we'll be back on the other side of these very important announcements. And we're back with more of The Personal Wealth Coach starring Jake and
Jeff
McClure. What would you like to talk about next?
I want to touch on something that's going on in the big picture that may be overlooked. There is a very clear division in the world right now between, on one side, autocratic states like Russia, China, Iran, and Turkey, as an example. Although Turkey wanders back and forth in the middle.
Sometimes autocratic, sometimes democratic, mostly autocratic.
And then the rest, and then the world over in the Western world, it's generally referred to as the Western world, which is where democracy still works, apparently. And of course, then we're back to having three worlds. And then there's the developing world where they're off somewhere else.
Yeah.
Anyway,
there's an equal chance of being autocratic or democratic in the developing world.
In any given moment.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, things are not going well in the autocratic world at all. And Russia obviously started this off with an attack. China has been threatening an attack. In both cases, those major countries economically appear to be in some difficulty, to say the least. This is a big picture in the world. Yes, Europe is almost certainly sliding into recession, but they made a big boo-boo. By the way, I read a really good article about that aspect. The deindustrialization of Germany is in The Economist. Germany's economic industrial miracle over the last 20 years or so, it said, has been obtained by buying energy very cheaply from one autocratic government, Russia, and selling goods to another autocratic government, China. And China is their number one customer in Germany. Obviously, their energy came from Russia, and they got cheap energy and sold a lot of stuff to China. Well, guess what? Now their cheap energy has gone away, and it's now very expensive energy, and they can't get it from Russia anymore. And China's economy is imploding. And this is a big thing. China, by most measures, has the second largest economy in the world. And they stayed out of the major 2007 through 9 economic crisis by building lots of real estate. And the government funded building of real estate. And after that, people borrowing money to build real estate, a rid of horrific thing. People who have bought homes in China over the last decade now see one third of them that they've paid for, by the way. They've paid for these homes. They've taken out loans to pay for the homes, and one third of them never got finished. There are companies like Evergrande, which was one of the largest real estate companies in the world, if not the largest at one point, that apparently have nothing. If they were in the United States, they would be in bankruptcy court. They are seeing an implosion in their real estate market, at least as severe as the implosion we saw in 2007 through 9 in the United States. And Jake, you're the authority on this. What percentage of the population of China is in lockdown right now?
There's a 290 million. That's about a fifth of the population of China in lockdown right now. And that's a rotating lockdown. So it's not this. It's been running right around 300 million people since around February. So, and it's not the same people. So it's like playing hide the bean in the cups. It's shuffling all around. Only minimum lockdowns are 3 weeks. And some of them are months on months on months. So it has definitely slowed the economy.
So what we're seeing is a major issue going on across the globe. And like all the other stuff overseas, there's very little we can do about it. But I think it's good to be aware of the fact that Russia is being backed into a corner. I don't know if we mentioned this last time, but there's reliable accounts that North Korea is now shipping ammunition to Russia.
Right. And then the first
North Korea,
the first Iranian drones have been captured by the Ukrainians in the Russian armament. So the Iranians are sending drones as well. Just quick side note, 4 countries in the circle of influence of Russia that have been kept peaceful by Russian military are at war with each other right now. Azerbaijan and Armenia are back at it. Tajikistan and Kyrgyzstan are back at it. And it's only that only started in this last week after the big Ukrainian counterattack.
It's
fascinating.
I've read a lot of history, and this reminds me of something. And so it's something to be prepared for, and it's a little scary. And that is, in World War I, similar things started happening in World War I to Russia, followed by a sudden, relatively unexpected collapse of the government.
The Tsar.
This is entirely possible. The entirely possible that the entire Russian government could collapse on us in short order, and that they have nuclear weapons. That's a little scary. And we're out of time for the first hour.
Yes, we are. If you would like to talk to us off the air, we actually give customized investment advice tailored to the people we're talking to. We do the management of the portfolio as well. Generally, this is higher net worth people. But if you'd like to talk to us off the air about the subject, you can call us locally at
254-947-1111.
That's voicemail on the weekend, but real live people during the week. Toll free, it's 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN, should you still have a landline. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com, where you can sign up for our newsletter, read our newsletter, listen to radio programs going back, get podcasts there. You can get podcasts wherever podcasts are available. You can contact us through the contact form or email us directly at Jeff or Jake at tpwc.com. We actually read those things. And if you want to go back in and peruse the newsletters going back, see what we were saying last year at this point and the year before that, it's worthwhile. Till next hour, this is the Personal Wealth Coach.